Well, you can say hi if you want to.
Hi, this is
Howdy.
Hi. Hello. Hi. Hi, this is Greg LeMond. Welcome to the VeloCast.
Nice, really nice, yeah.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the VeloCast. This week, we'll be mainly concerning ourselves with questions surrounding what may or may not happen in the Middle East, although we at least can concentrate on just the two-wheeled concerns and not the geopolitical ones that will likely bring about World War III. But first, currently reclining in a brown leather Chesterfield chair, swirling the contents of a cradled port glass in one hand while the other curls its index finger around a contented Cuban cigar is one Patrick Lefevre. The 65-year-old will, we're sure, be congratulating himself on another successful signing as Sam Bennett took the opening stage of the 2020 Tour Down Under, his first for De Koninck Quick Step.
Take a moment and cast your mind back to when we used to talk about when sprinters moved teams. Going back to Mark Cavendish and Mark Renshaw, his support man moving on from High Road, Marcel Kittel, Andre Greipel, all of these guys, when they moved teams, had relatively disappointing results at the start of the move. And we used to pass it off by saying, perfectly reasonable, you know, they've got to get time together to drill their lead-out trains. Cav particularly, you know, when he moved teams from High Road, we said, it's, you know, that was such a perfect setup. It's going to take time for him to get it together, get the lead-out train up to that perfect, almost team pursuit perfection that you need in a professional lead-out train. And we were quite right. You know, it's perfectly justifiable to say it takes time, because that is drilling which isn't natural to a lot of pro cyclists. You know, they have to know their place. And we actually saw an example of that in the what used to be the Tour Down Under crit from Caleb Ewan with his lead-out man, Roger Kluge. However, it's got to be said that Sam Bennett looks like he's been at De Koninck Quick Step for at least four seasons. They are totally up to speed. Sam is going to win huge this year.
I would totally agree with that. I think it may also come in to my long-standing theory that sprint trains are somewhat of a thing of the past, that they don't operate quite as they used to. They're not as effective or as much required in the pro peloton as they once were. But that doesn't take anything away from what we saw from De Koninck Quick Step and Sam Bennett in the opening stage. I think you're right. I think we are looking at the start, and granted it's only January, and it's very, very silly to be making predictions at this stage, but going on what we saw, it's going to be a very, very happy season for Sam after all the shenanigans that he had to get through in order to get to De Koninck Quick Step. I think that's going to be a very, very happy marriage.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and you're right, it's too early. We've seen particularly Andre Greipel perform super well in the Tour Down Under before. And the big gorilla is putting out massive power just now and actually is looking the best he's looked for ages. But he's done that in the Tour Down Under before and then flattered to deceive and gone on to have a moderately disappointing season based on the achievements that he's had in Australia. But Sam just looked like a man absolutely in his element. That Irish Champions jersey is arguably the best kit in that entire team. He had Ilio Kesa and then Shane Archibald and then Michael Morco, and they delivered him to perfection. You know, he was the fastest guy on the day, but he also had the best lead-out team, although it's not, you're quite right, it's not the days of Saico or High Road or whatever. But that all for one and one for all Wolfpack nonsense, that I really hate the Wolfpack thing, showed with the amount of work these guys were willing to do. And for Bennett, that monkey's off his shoulder now. You know, he's won his first stage for the new team. He's kind of, I've got to say, he must have enjoyed stuffing it up Bora Hansgrohe a wee bit. And I think we're going to see him be the best sprinter that we see in the World Tour this year. And I could be wrong, but I hope I'm not, because it's been building to this for seasons and I saw nothing to indicate that this was a flash in the pan. I'm just really excited for Sam Bennett. This move, now it's happened, is wonderful for him. And Patrick Lefevre, though he's a moaning old git, must have been, as you say, smoking a cigar in sheer joy after watching Bennett win.
And looking forward to what we're likely to see across the season, I think if Bennett goes to some of the classic races as support for the guys who will be in with a shout of winning, say, Paris-Roubaix or Flanders. He's building up the faith and the other guys that he will need when it comes to the Grand Tours, especially the Tour de France, where, you know, we talked last week about Alaphilippe not looking to go for yellow despite his two-week run in 2019. So it kind of puts more emphasis on sprinting and winning stages coming mm-hmm. from the Tour de France. So as I say, if he goes to some of the classic races and just as a support rider, that'll be returned in spades for him when it comes to the races that he wants to win.
Yeah, and look at the guys behind him. I mean, you're looking at Jasper Philipsen, who was really good for UAE. Ilia Viviani in fourth for Cofidis. Greipel in fifth. And as I say, Greipel has been putting out like 2,000 watt numbers in Strava. He's clearly super strong. Caleb Ewan, who was so dominant the day before, finished in seventh place. So, I mean, they're good, good riders. He's not racing against punters here. So, you know, bring it on, Sam. I've been moaned at about Sam Bennett by our chum Derek Troy for probably a decade. And Derek must be absolutely delighted to see his slightly unhealthy obsession with Sam start to come to fruition.
Well, Sam probably more worried about that slightly unhealthy dedication, and I'm wondering when the injunction is to run out and hope that he can get another one quickly. We will be talking about another sprinter later in the show, but moving on, well, Amanda Spratt was arguably the rider of the Australian Nationals and undoubtedly the all-time greatest rider of the Women's Tour Down Under, having won the GC for the past 3 years. But as Chaucer says, all good things must come to an end. Not that Ruth Winder taking the 2020 edition is a bad thing, you understand.
Well, what we saw here was a confirmation of the form that we'd seen in the run-up races to this, with Chloe Hosking winning the first stage. Amanda Spratt won the second stage, and that was actually the stage which shaped the finale, because she was away with Lippert and Winders, and they formed essentially the podium at the end. But what we've got here is essentially a wee break of the grip that Mitchell and Scott have had in this race, with Winders, who's the US champion for Trek Segafredo, managing to hold on, aided by a breakaway soaking up the bonus points in the final stage. But the great joy for us was we're finally getting to see some road racing. You know, it's not crits, which are fantastic in their own right and a certain wee skill set. We're seeing proper road racing, proper wee stage races happening. 2020's here.
And it would be better if we could see the entire race. We are, sorry, be a bit moany in the back of your, well, hey, everything's fantastic in Rosie World. We're still watching highlights of women's racing here, and I would have preferred to see the whole thing. What we did see, just going back to stage one, as you say, Chloe Hosking taking the opening round there, and Amanda Spratt taking stage through, while Ruth Winder setting herself up for the overall taking stage three.
Mm-hmm. The editing of the highlights is interesting, isn't it?
I'm
reminded of Andy Warhol in the late 60s, early 70s, actually.
I saw some highlights on Eurosport, on the website. You can go look this up. I don't think I've ever seen such bad editing of a video. There was commentators being cut off midway through a sentence, jumping randomly from one part of the race to the other. Honestly, you could have sat a chimp down in front of an editing suite and just got it to bang the keys, and it would probably have made a better job of the edit than we saw there.
I thought I was having a seizure and losing 30 seconds at a time.
Like that character from, what was it, the film Memento back in the day? You just suddenly blank out, where am I?
It's got to be said, though, we have to be thankful, because, joking aside, we're getting coverage of women's racing. And repeat all of the moans we've had about this in the past. But this, I mean, this is proper racing. You know, there was real fights on, real tactics going on. I mean, we saw in that final stage where the breakaway got away and soaked up the bonus points, Lippert's team particularly were very active trying to get those bonuses to get the rider into the lead. So, you know, women's racing is maturing year on year. And this looked like another brilliant example of the Women's Tour Down Under. I just wish we'd seen a bit more of it. But, you know, to see Trek Segafredo and the US champion hit the top step this early in the season, it's a good indication that that team is on the right direction. And Mitchell and Scott didn't look like slow coaches. You know, they were still there. And there's the strength and depth, because even after, you know, those relatively hard stages, the gaps weren't huge. So a good start to the women's season, and thoroughly enjoyable for what we could watch.
And to Amanda Spratt herself, she was the first to congratulate Windsor on a win, although she must be disappointed. That would have been four wins in a row from Spratt, and she clearly was in form, as we saw at the Nationals.
Yeah, and the sad thing is, we talked about this last week, Sarah and I were saying Amanda Spratt doesn't win as much as you expect. And kind of like Richie Port, a lot of those expectations come from the, you know, her performances and his performances in the Tour Down Under. So this must have been another one of her big objectives for the year. But she can't complain. She was part of the move that, well, she can't complain because, you know, she wants to win. But she was part of the move that forced that winning trio. And she won a stage. She was active throughout the race. So although she didn't win the overall again, hugely creditable performance.
Yesterday in Het Nieuwsblad, it was reported that the 2020 edition of the Tour of Oman is to be cancelled following the death of Sultan Qaboos bin Said Al Said 11 days ago. The country is in the midst of a 40-day mourning period where certain events cannot take place.
Do you know when Liz dies, our queen, there will be a wailing and a gnashing of teeth, there will be national mourning. There will be a state funeral that will, it'll be one of those occasions that people who were alive at the time will remember to their grandchildren 40 or 50 years later, just purely for the spectacle. But life will go on. You know, we've got a democratic society in bunny years, given recent events. But, you know, it's a constitutional monarchy. It's an adjunct to the actual governance of the state. The Tour of Oman is an absolute monarchy, and it's an absolute hereditary monarchy. So the death of the head of state in that country is a far, far bigger deal than we'll have even when Madge pops it. So whilst regrettable, and particularly regrettable if we'd been going to get decent coverage, because I used to get mocked for going on about the light in Oman, and our chum Rosie, who lives in Oman for a big chunk of the year and teaches there, loves the country and goes on at great length about it. So although I was really looking forward to Oman and, you know, waxing lyrical about his fabulous light, given that absolute monarchy thing, this isn't a big surprise, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, a very, very long run. Nothing in comparison, of course, to Her Madge, as you called her a moment or so ago.
Is it 1970?
1970, so a 50-year run, into nothing to be sniffed at. There is some confusion here. The race was announced on the 16th of January, which is almost a week after the Sultan had passed away. Mm-hmm. However, that we've now got this report in Het Nieuwsblad saying that it has now been cancelled, but the riders, the teams, the fans were all a bit confused as to whether the race would go ahead, because in announcing on the 16th of January, as I say, almost a week after the Sultan had passed away, that's certainly within, of course, the mourning period, and you'd be wondering why, if the race wasn't going to go ahead, they would bother to announce it at all. I mean, it's not like it was announced the same day or the day after, whatever. They had a good 6 days to formulate a response. Mm-hmm. And ASO themselves apparently have made no statement on it, so we're a bit kind of up in the air. And to what you were saying about the fact it's not televised or anything, absolutely, we should be kind of disappointed that that's still not going to be the case. I guess for the riders and the teams, it's a wee bit of a hole in their preparation for bigger races. You know, it is an event which they would have been using for at least training, you know, proper in race training for future events. So they will be upset about that, I guess.
Yeah, on the plus side, the kind of Quick Step can now say they're in carbon surplus, can't they? because they can say, well, we'd budgeted for a man, but now we haven't, so we don't have to plant so many trees.
Sorry, Mont Ventoux, you'll have to wait another year.
Joking aside, in terms of preparation, it is important. But this isn't, it's not like a Western monarchy. So the fact it's not going ahead actually surprises me less than the talk that it was possibly going to go ahead. So we'll see. But you know, the Tour of Oman, every time we talk about these races in, you know, the United Arab Emirates and, you know, Qatar, we have to bring up the human rights records of the countries they're held in. Oman, although it has big questions, actually is possibly the most enlightened of those Middle Eastern states. And certainly the terrain, you know, even that wide, wide road up Green Mountain was pretty good racing terrain. So I'll miss it. You know, and certainly Alexei Lutsenko will miss it because it was apparently one of his big objectives of the year every single year. But I'd be really amazed if it goes ahead, and all indications are that it won't.
Apparently the Sultan is to be succeeded by his cousin, who is a former president of the Oman Football Association. I'm gutted. I don't want to be kind of pouring scorn over someone's death, but why couldn't it have been somebody from the Oman Cycling Association and we can get, you know, some more money poured into the sport? All the money's going to go to the football, isn't it?
Well, I don't know if sports governance is anything to go by. He's probably the president of every single sports association in Oman.
Oh, that's a fair point. That's a fair point, well made. Let's move on. A warning has been issued to the Pavé of Paris-Roubaix that Mathieu van der Poel is to pay them a visit this year. A spokescobble for the Pavé itself denied claims that the Arenberg Trench is bricking itself.
Do you know there's this thing about over expectation? Van der Poel and, you know, Wout van Aert as well have made such a huge impact in the sport and, you know, their first couple of years on the road that everybody thinks they're going to win everything. And you and I have talked about, you know, Jan Ulrich in 1997, all sorts of precedents for people who we expected to dominate for ages and it didn't happen.
Eddie Bosenhagen is the new Eddie Merckx.
Yeah, well, yeah, that was one. And Van der Poel going to Roubaix, I would be remiss if I didn't refer people to many, many previous This Week in Cycling Histories with me and Killian, talking about how Roubaix is a race for the older gentleman who gets the experience in the cobbles and finally comes to fruition. The classic example of that maybe being Gilbert Duclos-Lassalle. But I'm going to say Mathieu van der Poel's going to win the bloody thing this year because he's just absolutely amazing.
I was going to call you out there and say if it's the case, and of course it is, that Paris-Roubaix is an event for the more mature rider. We used to say that of a Grand Tour. We used to say that of the Tour de France, which you can't possibly win until you're well into your 20s, if not into your 30s, but look what happened in 2019.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, everything in my head says he can't win. You know, he just can't. But then everything in my head said he was done with 5K to go with the Amstel Gold last year.
Yep.
You know, it's just, he's just going to win the bloody thing, isn't he? Which is going to be magnificent. I mean, I'm incredibly excited about it already, to the point where, you know, you and I have been talking and we know we do better shows when we're not at races because you can actually watch the thing and, you know, you can do proper analysis and where it's by the roadside. Do you remember sitting in some weird, crappy motorway services trying to watch Fabian Cancellara's highlights on the way back to recording a show? You know, it's horrible. I just want to stand by the roadside and cheer as that Alpecin Phoenix team kit goes past and, you know, be a moment in history, you know, to see one of the greats anointed as the winner of one of, well, for me, the best race in the world. And this is all a bit hyperbolic, but he's a once-in-a-generation talent, you know, and I really think he's got it in him. Now, In Paris-Roubaix, anything can happen. You know, I've always said if you can be in the top 10, you can win the thing. And if you're a capable winner, you can easily end up in the top 10. You know, that's the inverse of that, is something can happen. You can puncture, somebody can shove you onto the verge in the pavé, a spectator can, you know, walk in front of you, somebody can fall off in front of you. But I really think Vanderpool has what it takes to win this race and win it early. And I could not be more excited.
You know, long-term listeners of this show will, of course, be aware that John being hyperbolic about a given rider is tantamount to, or the equivalent thereof, sticking as many pins into a voodoo doll as you could possibly hope to manage. I think after all that great praise for the young rider, that's him. He's finished. There is no more Matthew Van Der Poel.
He'll pop a tendon in his knee in the spring or something. That's it. I've cursed him. But no, I really think if he doesn't win, he'll be top five, and that'll be an indication that he's got it. He has the makings of a classic Paris-Roubaix rider. And for me, that's the best kind of rider that exists.
Mm. Do you know, I was kind of reading through this story, which we've focused on Matthew Van Der Poel going to Paris-Roubaix with his team, gaining a wildcard slot, of course, and the other teams that are going Arkea Samsic, B&B Hotels, Vital Concept, Nippo Delco, One Provence, Circus, Wanty-Gobert, in total Direct Energy, all of course getting spots for various reasons. I had no idea why, but it kind of seemed to me when I was reading it that six wildcards at Ruby seemed like an awful lot, until I looked it up and realised that it had been seven up until this year.
Yeah.
I'm stunned by this. I thought there was like three or four. When did it become a case that there was seven?
Well, and the thing is, the wild cards rather are capable of making a big difference in the race. I mean, the other one is for Nippo Delco, One Provence is Siska Vickius. You know, that it's a race where anything can happen, and the wild cards often play a part. You know, even if it's early on, where they're trying to get in the break to try and get exposure, that can help shape the race. And if you look at Van Der Poel's schedule, he's got some amazing rides lined up. You know, this whole, I'm not in a world tour team, I'm just going to take it easy. What is it, Strade Bianche, Milan San Remo, depending on what the hell happens with Milan San Remo after the Poggio landslide, Dwars door Vlaanderen, Tour of Flanders, Paris-Roubaix, confirmed. And then he's moving on, and maybe, this road racing, it's quiet amusement for me. I'm really going to concentrate on the cross-country mountain bike in Tokyo. What a guy.
So what are you actually saying here? Are we going to see someone win, four monuments in a single season and an Olympic gold?
Well, I could see him, all joking aside, you know, and this is hyperbole. I could see him win the Tour of Flanders, I could see him win Roubaix, and I could see him win the Olympics cross-country mountain bike. And yeah, what a season that would be. That's one for the ages.
It certainly would be, and I'm snipping that comment out, and I shall be using it towards the end, or even after the summer, to remind you of exactly what you're predicting here, because that would be some season.
Now, let's go back, actually, to a previous show. And think about your review, where one of my highlights of the year was Wout van Aert's chase in Strade Bianche, where he just refused to give up even though he was shed again on that final climb into Siena. And, you know, can you imagine a showdown between Wout and Mathieu van der Poel in any of these races? They're doing a Peter Sagan without all of the flamboyance. Do you know what I mean? They ride like you expect Sagan to ride, but they don't have the media presence. And that means, you know, as stars in the sport, they may not be quite as exciting as Petter has been, you know, maybe will be in the future. But on the road, can you think of more exciting races than you've seen those two involved in recent, you know, the last couple of years?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I think as soon as one of them pulls off, I mean, I'm not saying that the Amstel Gold isn't a big event, but as soon as one of them pulls off a monument, that'll be it. It will be Peter Sagan all over again. And I think we are shaping up for one of those decades, really, where
yeah.
those two, plus a couple of others possibly, will be the story of each year, who's going to get the upper hand. I mean, I would say right now, Mathieu van der Poel is looking the most promising. I was kind of more in the Wout van Aert camp towards the start of last year, but the way the Mathieu van der Poel kind of has eclipsed him, there's no
yeah.
two ways about it, has been really, really interesting, and it will be more so to see how that rivalry develops over certainly this year and the years to come.
Yeah, and how Wout comes back from that, you know, not terrible injury, but bad enough. So it's a big year for those two. And the only slight regret, and we talked about it last year, is we were delighted that Wout's granddad was, or sorry, Mathieu's granddad was by the roadside at Amstel Gold to see that victory. I wish he'd lived another 2 or 3 years to see what his grandson would become, because I think we're looking at, you know, one that will be mentioned in maybe the top 10 names of cycling in all time when we look back, you know, 30 years from now.
The route of the 2020 UAE Tour has been announced, and while it once again centres around Hatta Dam and Jabal Hafid, it also offers up a sterling peloton with the likes of Mark Cavendish, Alejandro Valverde, Rohan Dennis and Tadej Pogacar confirmed as starters.
Well, Tadej Pogacar is somebody who's one of my big, big hopes for the year. He's the name that keeps popping to the front of my head, and this is the first time I think we'll see him turn a pedal in anger. Valverde's ridden well here before, used it as a good preparation for his year. Mark Cavendish has a lot to prove. You know, there are some sprinters coming through, and not just Sam Bennett, but a huge number of others who look almost as impressive as Cavendish did in his prime. So the old guy's got something to prove, but, you know, you'd be a fool to write him off. He's moved team. He's back in the kind of bosom of a support squad that he knows well and have made him perform well in the past. So this is a race which usually, I mean, Hatta Dam, I like. It's a great stage finish. I enjoy Jabal Hafid. It's a good test. But it's not a race I tend to get excited about. But I'm actually probably more excited to see what happens with the sprints in this race.
There is a reason, of course, that I highlighted this as a story, because it's not really about the race per se, like yourself. It's not an event that I get hugely worked up about. But I think because of some of the little kind of sub-stories that are going on and will come to some manner of, if not conclusion, then certainly add a chapter or two to each of those stories, it's worth highlighting. Mark Cavendish, you mentioned... Also on the back of this, Mark hasn't been selected for the GB squad for the final World Cup event of the season over in Canada, and that is likely to mean that he won't get to go to Tokyo at the Olympics this year. If that's the case, it puts a renewed focus on what Cav is going to do with his road season. And as you rightly highlighted, we've got guys like Sam Bennett and Caleb Ewan really firing on all cylinders even this early in the season.
Yeah.
And my worry with Mark Cavendish is this is a move to a new team which he arguably didn't need to make, that he maybe should have hung up his wheels, and whether we're going to see just one of those awful seasons from a formerly great rider, one of those ones that it's like kicking up.
I'll say it again, the best sprinter the world has ever seen.
No, and I think you're right in that. And I kind of feel slightly icky at the prospect of seeing the greatest sprinter the world has ever seen being left in the dust as he kind of flounders his way through races this year.
I've got no idea what's going to happen. Apparently he's putting out good numbers in training, but we've heard that before. He's happier in his new team, but, you know, we've heard that before as well. Cav is, he's a bit of an enigma. A lot of it is mental, but there's also this point where an older body just can't compete when it comes to the kind of explosive, just sheer energy you need in a World Tour sprint. And I really hope we haven't seen him hang on 2 or 3 seasons too late. You know, I love to see riders go out and top. And Cav isn't the kind of rider like, you know, the recently retired Bernie Eisel, who can find a career once he's passed his best as a road captain who will marshal his squad, pass on his experience, all that kind of thing. Cav is a, you know, he's an incandescent light at the front of a team. He's somebody who needs to win, who wants to win. And if he can't, I'm like you, I'll feel a bit, just a bit blah about it, and I really hope his career doesn't end in a whisper rather than a roar. I hope the best for him this year, but I'm not hoping too hard, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, sure. And in a similar vein, Chris Froome is also looking to return to racing at this race as well, not confirmed. And a lot of the reports surrounding Chris Froome at the minute are, we'll see what happens. And I think that's fair. I mean, I don't think even he will know what will be the case as soon as he turns a pedal in anger. It's astonishing to me that he's even on a bike at this stage, never mind looking to race in the coming month or so. But I think it will. I don't think we should make any definitive conclusions about whichever race we see Chris Froome come back to. But it'll certainly be interesting to know in what kind of form, if any, he is. I mean, Team Ineos have definitively said now that the past two Tour de France winners, Geraint Thomas and Egan Bernal, will head up the squad when it comes to July. But I do
they'll have a trident.
That's the other worrying aspect of this, is that if Chris Froome is showing Tour winning form when it comes to, you know, the middle of June, what on earth is going to happen there? I do think that there possibly is a space still left, and I think it would be daft not to, should Froome come, as I say, to that point in the season where he's managed to get back on racing terms with his peers, for him not to be afforded the opportunity to go for that fifth.
Well, you know, over our decade at the Velocast, my my predictive skills have been unparalleled.
Take that in whichever way you want to, folks.
Well, no, I'm going to be extremely explicit. They've been 100% wrong. I mean, going back to episode, what, 4 or 5, where I said DI2, it's just a flash in the pan. It's a loss leader. Nobody will bother with these electric gears. You know, it's just a development thing to show what they can do. It'll never catch on. And I kind of built on that with an increasing number of incredibly wrong predictions over the years. And I'm going to say Chris Froome will never win another race. I think that crash, and this is no reflection, we've talked about this before, this is no reflection in Chris's competitive spirit, his drive to win. I just think that crash, which was potentially life-ending, never potentially career-ending, has finished a career which should have finished with 5 tours, you know, put him on that same pedestal as Merckx, Anquetil, Hino, Indurain, and it'll leave him one short. You know, I just don't think he's got it anymore. There's a lot of brave talk. You know, that story which came out about the training camp in December was refuted very quickly in social media. He's been at other training camps since. But there's a sense of, I've said it before, you know, the hyenas circling the old lion, which it's very palpable about Froome. I think he's done. And I don't think it's his spirit. I don't think it's anything to do with him not wanting it enough. I think his body's just screwed. And it's that simple.
I don't disagree with that. I mean, I think from a purely logical point of view, and I mean that in its strictest sense, I don't know how you can say that, because we just don't know.
Because I'm used to waffling shite on a podcast. That's how I can say it.
Well, that's a very good point. Well made, yes. That aside, you know, as I say, from a strict logic point of view, we just don't know at this stage. It wouldn't be beyond the realms of possibility for everything you've said to be proven utterly correct. But equally so, because we've only seen or read what happened in the crash and the extent of the injuries, we don't actually know what he himself was like in his recovery period, other than the talk, which of course will accentuate the positives. We just don't know. So, I mean, it's, again, the reason I highlighted this story is it's not the definitive chapter. That won't come until whether he's at the tour in July or not, or indeed what happens right to the death of the tour. We just won't know what the definitive story is going to be. But right now, we just need to look at each instance as it comes about. And if he does race the UAE tour, that will be another marker in this decisive, I think, story of Chris Froome, whether he goes on to win a fifth or indeed is in that club, which is, well, I think he'd be in a club of his own. I don't think anybody's finished their career with one tour short of five, have they?
The only thing I'd say about that is that if you look at the people who are coming through, you know, your Egan Bernals, your Tejesh Pogačars, established stars who are, you know, maybe in the twilight of their career but are still capable of big wins, Geraint Thomas, slightly older, Vincenzo Nibali, people who are coming through like Thibaut Pinot, who looked very credible until faltering recently. You're looking at people who haven't had serious injuries, who are building year on year, who are coming into their form in the younger things, you know, like Bernal, who are coming into the sheer force of the bulk of their career. People like Pinot, who have learned through years of development what it takes to win a big race and haven't had any big issues since, you know, that one where he had trouble descending because he was scared of speed. You're looking at people who are coming into this year's tour with no major setbacks, on a clear path of development, who are getting better and better. And you're looking at a Froome who charitably is towards the end of his career and had a potentially career-ending issue last year. It's really hard to see him coming back. Now, if he does, it'll be fantastic. And he'll have to win with some panache against the kind of opposition that he's up against now. I just can't see it. But you're right, we have to wait and see. Because for someone with the drive to win that we've seen in Chris Froome, you'd be a fool to completely write him off. I just can't see it.
Now, the other name that I mentioned in connection with this story, Rohan Dennis, now, of course, a teammate of Chris Froome at Team Ineos, was interviewed, not specifically about the UAE Tour, but an interesting interview regarding his exit from the Tour de France last year, a big, big story, but was saying that this apparently was for the benefit of his family. Now, I'm very confused by this take, and I don't in any way wish to denigrate or downplay any personal issues Rowan and his wife were possibly working through at the time. I'm just not getting how leaving the tour before the individual time trial solves any of that, especially when you're a TT specialist. If he was going to let his team know what was going on and said, well, look, guys, I need to go home after this stage, he probably would have had the blessing of everybody and everybody, a good compromise for all concerned. I just can't see how, regardless, as I say, of whatever personal problems Rohan and his wife were having, come home right this minute or I'm leaving you would have been a thing. I just don't get it.
No, it's an interesting piece, isn't it? Because I think it's fair to say that you and I have had our occasional issues with not particularly rational viewpoints on the business of living. However, what came out to me through this whole thing with him talking about, you know, saving his family, not wanting to soil his relationship with the team, why he withdrew from the tour, I kind of thought he needed better care. You know, from management, from the team. If things had got to this particularly difficult phase in a relationship between a team and a rider, it should have been flagged up. The management should have dealt with it. More than that, his agent should have been looking after Rohan Dennis's best interests. And in this case, clearly wasn't, because he got to, you know, he let things get to a stage where in the biggest showcase in the world, prior to a stage which Rohan was quids in to win, his rider just got off the bike and walked away and left the team confused, left fans confused, had a PR disaster. So this for me isn't focused on Rohan Dennis. You know, he can have whatever issues he wants, because we've all been there. You know, there are times where you can't see the wood for the trees when you're looking out from within to see what's best for yourself. What comes forward to me from this is his agent should have done better. His agent should have been taking care of his rider's rights, his rider's mental health, all of that kind of thing. Because Rohan Dennis isn't some punter that you don't pay attention to. You know, he's on his day the best time trialist in the world. This is somebody who demands your immediate and constant attention as an agent. The team should have been aware of what was going on. You know, they should have been paying enough attention to the rider to know that he was at the ragged edge of his mental abilities, that he wasn't right. So this for me is an issue of duty of care and support as opposed to an individual rider's behaviour. And I think both the team and the agent fell far short.
I don't think that's unfair. I can't see the logic in, sorry, there's that word again, in the way that this story, as explanation for what happened, is holding that much water. I agree with everything that you've said. I'm just kind of thinking that, right, okay, yes, the team management and indeed his agent could have acted in a better way, but I think possibly Rohan could have helped along that in a much better way. And of course, personal issues are very, very difficult to judge rationally.
Well, I would say, to be blunt, it depends how mental he was.
Yes, this is
very true. That's not very PC, but it's exactly how I feel. I've had situations where my view of reality was extremely distorted, and that may have been the case for Rohan. The other thing about this piece is it reminded me that Fran Miller's the INEOS CEO, which, given her record in PR, is a slightly worrying thing, isn't it?
Ever so slightly, yes, but we shall probably be best to move on from that one. Finally, some good news for Mariana Voss fans. And frankly, if you're not a Mariana Voss fan, you've no business here. The world's greatest cyclist was released from hospital following successful surgery on an artery in her groin on Thursday.
To have the season she's just had with an arterial problem in her groin is an indication of the class of the rider. I think she's certainly the top three cyclists of any gender of all time. And, you know, if she retired at this point, she would have no apologies to make. She would need no justification. You know, if the doctors had said to her, look, Marianne, you need this operation if you're going to carry on, and she'd gone, ah, stuff it, I've had 20 years of being at the absolute top of the sport. I would have been, yep, you've had a great career, Marianne. You're one of the greats. I think she wants to come back for this year's Olympics. And I think this operation was necessary for that. And it's a testament to her drive and to the kind of spirit we saw in her wonderful results last season that this one of the greatest riders the world has ever seen will grace our screens in the Olympics this year. Get well, Marianne, and, you know, I just love her. I just love her.
I mean, if that is the case, then it's been timed immensely well, because you've got a six-week recovery period from this type of operation, which would put her back in the bike and back to racing to peak for July and the Olympic Games.
Cyclocross, who cares about that? Let's just have the Olympics.
Cyclocross
season's done. I mean, that's where the recovery is. And our performances in the road last year were wonderful. I mean, just wonderful. And I think she's just aiming for one thing this year, and it's Tokyo.
Here's the thing, only mildly related. I was watching a Belgian crime drama on TV a few days ago, and of course, speaking absolutely no Dutch, was glued to the subtitles. However, words do kind of leap out at you when you're watching something in a foreign language, especially with, you know, French or Dutch, or to a lesser extent, I guess, German, as English has roots in all of those. But a sentence that popped out was the following: Ich sag ein kleiner Voss. And I kind of looked up and went, did you say Voss? And of course looked at the translation, which was, I saw a little fox. It turns out that Voss is Dutch for fox, so Mariana is a fox.
Well, no, she definitely is. Look at, yeah, I mean, she's just lovely. Which, I mean, I hate to be a Scotsman of a certain age. I've got to say, you know, my best mate Andy is married to Yvonne, a Dutch girl. And I've met lots of Yvonne's friends over the years. And whenever they ask what I do for a living, I say, well, you know, I talk about cycling. And look at all the cyclists from Holland over the years. Look at the recent ones, you know, Lars Boom, Mathieu van der Poel, you know, all of those big names. And you know, the only two names that ever come up are Leontien van Meursel and Marianne Vos. You know, that says so much.
Yeah, just to, I mean, I'll remind you this because I know I've told you before. I met Marianne, it was Sarah introduced me to Marianne Vos, and she was resplendent in white, completely white, as a world champion's kit. Positively glowed. She's like an angel, that woman. Astonishing. Really, really. And I'm being genuine here. Absolutely astonishing in person.
Yeah, every time you hit the last lap of a cyclocross, an angel gets its wings.
Mm. Well, thank you for joining us today as we discussed all the goings-on in cycling. And hopefully you can do so again for another wrap-up of the two-wheeled news in the next edition of The Velocast.